Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
A dark forest path under the moonlight, where a ghostly infant sits alone. Its small silhouette glows faintly in the mist, suggesting an eerie innocence hiding a lurking danger. Do you hear that? It's past midnight, the trees are still, and somewhere in the darkness you hear it, a baby's cry. Your heart skips. Why would a baby be out here, alone in the woods? The grind grows louder, desperate, but you step off the path, drawn by instinct. Someone needs help. Your flashlight shakes in your hand as you follow the sobs deeper into the forest.
You find a bundle of cloth on the ground, tiny arms reaching out. It's so small, just an infant. The crying stops as you kneel down. Hey there, little one.
But suddenly the bundle moves. The baby turns its face up to you, and those eyes, they're not right. They're glowing red. Before you can scream, the infant's innocent face twists into a horrifying grin. Tiny lips peel back to reveal sharp, needle-like teeth. Its cry turns into a cackle that echoes through the clearing. You stumble back, heart pounding, too shocked to move as the creature lunges.
Whoa. Okay, Alex. That's enough. You're giving me goosebumps already.
Sorry, Reed. I had to set the mood. That spine-chilling scene is one nearly every Filipino knows to fear. It's the classic warning we've heard since childhood. Never follow a crying baby's voice in the woods, because it might not be a baby at all. It could be a chianak.
And with that unsettling image planted in our listeners' minds, welcome, everyone, to the Stories Philippines podcast. This is episode 3 of season 1, Creatures of the Night, Philippine Mythical Beings. I'm Reed, and I'm already checking over my shoulder after that intro.
And I'm Alex. Tonight we're diving into one of the most disturbing legends in Filipino folklore. It's a creature that looks and sounds like the most innocent thing you can imagine, but carries a deadly secret. The episode is called The Tianak's Cry, Lullabies of Doom.
If you joined us for our previous episodes on other creatures of the night, you know we love to explore the history and spine-tingling stories behind these myths. And I have a feeling tonight's topic will be particularly haunting. I mean, a vampiric demon baby? Doesn't get creepier than that.
Definitely. There's something so deeply unsettling about a crying infant turning out to be a monster. It preys on our natural instincts to nurture and protect. It's like the ultimate betrayal of innocence.
Mm-hmm. So, get comfortable. Well, if you can. And maybe turn the lights on for this one. We'll start with the origins and nature of the Tianak, then share chilling encounters and even a final story told from a haunted parent's perspective. Trust me, you'll want to stick around until the end if you're brave enough.
Ready? Let's carefully step into the darkness and listen for that faint cry. Because it's time to talk about the Tianak.
Okay, Alex, first things first. What exactly is a Tianak? For listeners who might not be familiar, how would you describe it?
Spelled Tianak, sometimes spelled Tianak or Chanak in other sources, is essentially a vampiric creature from Philippine mythology that takes on the form of a baby or toddler. It's a kind of demon child in our folklore. The usual story is exactly what we painted in the intro. A traveler hears a baby's cries in the jungle, goes to investigate, and this seemingly helpless infant transforms into a terrifying monster.
Right. It's a deception at its core. The word Tiyanak itself even has clues. I remember reading that the name comes from older Filipino terms like Patay na anak, an anak, meaning dead child. Over time, Patay Nak or Tiyanak became just Tiyanak. So the name hints that we're dealing with something that's not a living baby, but maybe the spirit or undead version of one.
Exactly. And belief in the Tiyanak goes way back, long before horror movies and TV shows picked it up. We're talking ancient pre-colonial times. In fact, one of the earliest written records of a similar creature is from a Spanish friar in the 1580s. He wrote about a Tagalog belief in something called Patyanak. Back then, they said if a woman died while giving birth, her spirit and that of the child might linger, crying at night and causing mischief. But originally, Patyanak might have referred to a ghostly mother and child situation, or at least some spirit surrounding childbirth.
That's interesting. It sounds a bit like a precursor to the Tiyanak legend, a mother and infant who died in childbirth haunting the living. There's a resemblance to other Southeast Asian myths too. Like in Malaysia and Indonesia, there's the Pontianak or Kuntilanak, usually the ghost of a woman who died with a child still in her womb, often depicted as a vengeful female spirit. In their stories, the mother is the scary one, whereas in ours, the child itself is the monster. But even the names Pontianak and Patyanak sound similar, as if these legends are cousins.
They probably are related in some ancient way. With so many cultures trading stories, and with our Austronesian ancestors spreading across islands, it's likely these myths influenced each other. But the Filipino Tiyanak evolved into its own distinct creature over time.
Different regions in the Philippines actually have different versions of the Tiyanak's origin. For example, among some ethnic groups in Mindanao, or the Mandaya people, there's a belief that a Tiyanak is the spirit of a child whose mother died before giving birth. So the baby was, as the legend says, born in the ground, buried with the mother. It never got to live, and thus it emerges as this restless, vengeful little creature.
Wow, born in the ground is a chilling phrase. Imagine a baby that never saw the light of day, crawling out of its mother's grave. It's tragic and horrifying at the same time.
It really is, and that origin emphasizes how old and embedded this legend is, because it's tied to the very real fear of dying in childbirth, which was sadly common in ancient times. People created these stories to explain or personify such tragedies.
Now, fast forward a bit to the Spanish colonial era, 16th, 17th century. The myth gets woven into the new Christian framework. The Spanish friars were quick to link the Tiyanak to Catholic concepts of sin and salvation. They started saying, Tiyanaks are the souls of infants who died before being baptized.
Right. Under Catholic influence, being unbaptized meant a child's soul couldn't enter heaven. So folklore took that idea and basically said an unbaptized baby might return as a Tiyanak, an angry, lost spirit stuck in the mortal world. It turned into a kind of cautionary tale. Make sure to baptize your kids, or else, you know, they might turn into a monster.
It's kind of morbid if you think about it, telling grieving parents that their dead infant could come back as a blood-sucking demon because a ritual wasn't performed in time.
Very morbid, but it shows how folklore and religion mix. Over time, the legend adapted. Any baby who died too soon, especially without Christian rites, was a candidate to become a Tiyanak. Some versions specifically mention stillborn babies or those who died before being given a name. There's this belief that naming a child gives it an identity and maybe a sort of protection for its soul. So a baby who died nameless could wander as a Tiyanak, searching for someone to name it and bring it peace.
That's so sad. The idea of a little soul just wanting a name, an identity so it can move on. It adds a layer of poignancy to the horror. Not all Tiyanak tales paint them as purely evil. Some suggest they are confused or angry spirits because they were deprived of life or recognition.
True. And then there's the more modern twist in the myth. In the 20th century, people started saying that even aborted fetuses could become Tianic. This is likely a newer spin, part moral lesson, part urban legend, implying that these unborn spirits seek revenge. It's like the folklore evolving to address contemporary issues, a way to instill fear or guilt by suggesting the spirit of an unborn child might come back vengeful.
So basically, across different eras, we have a variety of origin stories. Babies who died at birth or before being born, especially if the mother also died. Babies who died before baptism or before they were named. Aborted or abandoned babies whose spirits turned malevolent. I even heard some folks in certain provinces refer to Tianac as Impacto or Impactito, which just means like an evil spirit or a demon offspring. There's a legend about a Tianac being the child of an Aswan, a Filipino shape-shifting ghoul and a human woman, kind of like a demonic hybrid child that's cursed from birth. Wow, yeah. I've come across that too, the unholy union of an Aswan and a human producing a Tianac. It shows how interconnected our mythical creatures are, like one can spawn another if an Aswang in disguise seduced someone, their baby could be a Tianac, for example. Those are more obscure tales, but they're out there.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Impacto, because in some local languages, that's a term used interchangeably with Tianac. Different regions have different names or nuances. In Pampanga, central Luzon, for example, I've heard of the Antuanac, or Antianac, or Glutianac, but careful, that one's a bit different. The Kapampangan Antianac is described not as demon babies, but as an ancient race of small forest beings, powerful and in tune with nature. The name sounds similar. Anak means child, yet it's more of a nature spirit than a vampiric baby.
That's a great point. Just because it sounds the same doesn't mean it is the same. The Philippines has 7,000 plus islands and dozens of ethno-linguistic groups, each with its own rich folklore. So some stories diverged. Like you said, the Kapampangans have anti-anak, which is more like forest guardians. Meanwhile, in most other areas, when people say Tianac or Impacto, they mean the demon baby.
So we have this mosaic of beliefs, indigenous animist ideas about spirits of the dead, then layered with Spanish Catholic notions of lost souls, plus modern moral storytelling. All that gave birth, so to speak, to the Tianac legend we know today.
It's a legend that's very much alive in the Filipino imagination. Ask anyone who grew up in the provinces, and they'll likely shudder at the word Tianac. But it's not just the origin that makes it scary, it's how this creature acts. Let's talk about what a Tianac does when it's on the prowl, and what it actually looks like when it reveals itself.
So, Reed, we keep mentioning the baby's cry. That's really the hallmark of the Tianac, isn't it? That deceptive, heart-wrenching crying sound that lures people in?
Absolutely. The Tianac's cry is its primary weapon. It's often described as uncannily real and undistinguishable from a real infant's wailing echoing in the night. Imagine hearing that in a dark forest or even near your home on the outskirts of a village. It triggers something primal in you. You want to help. You think an innocent life is in danger.
And that's exactly why it's so effective. It preys on our compassion. You might be walking home late or out hunting and suddenly, waha, a faint cry. You'd feel compelled to investigate, right? I know I would, even knowing these stories. I'd have a hard time ignoring a baby.
Same here. It's almost reflexive. The folklore really leans into that. The idea that the kindest, most well-meaning people are the ones who get trapped. It's a caution. Sometimes your empathy can lead you into danger, especially when something is not what it seems.
Now, interesting detail. Many stories say if the cry sounds very far away, the Tianac might actually be very close. And if the cry sounds nearby and loud, the creature could still be some distance off. It's like the Tianac can throw its voice or create an auditory illusion.
Yeah, it's a freaky little trick. You think, oh, the baby's just over that hill, I hear it clearly. But in truth, it's still deep in the bush, and you're just wandering further in. Or vice versa, a faint whimper makes you think it's far, so you lower your guard. Then suddenly it pounces because it was right at your feet all along. It really knows how to confuse its victims.
And once someone gets close enough or picks up what they think is a helpless baby, that's when the Tyanek reveals its true form. So what does a Tyanek actually look like when it's not pretending to be an adorable newborn?
Well, accounts vary, but they all agree on one thing. It's grotesque. In the most common version, the Tyanek still resembles a baby at first glance. Maybe toddler-sized. Think of a cherub that's gone very, very wrong. Its formerly angelic face contorts. The eyes bulge wide, often glowing red or burning with malice. Its toothless, pink gums sprout sharp fangs made for tearing flesh. Its little fingernails elongate into dirty, jagged claws. Some say the skin darkens or the body becomes hairy or scaly. And it might emit this demonic cackle or a shriek, said the Thax.
I'm visualizing it and getting chills, like a baby-sized vampire goblin. And as if the physical description isn't disturbing enough, some stories add that the creature can move with terrifying speed. It's not a crawling, cooing infant anymore. It leaps and scrambles incredibly fast. People say once it reveals itself, you can't easily outrun it. You drop the baby in shock and run, but it will chase you down on all fours, or even jumping through trees.
That's right, there are tales of it almost flying at people's throats. One minute it's away in your arms, the next it's latched onto your back, claws digging in. Which reminds me that Tyanek is often described as a vampiric creature, meaning it drinks blood. Like a tiny Dracula, it will bite into victims and suck their blood dry, giggling the whole time, according to some legends.
It takes delight in the kill. I've read that giggle you mentioned. That might be one of the most unnerving parts. A twisted, infantile giggle echoing in the dark as it feeds. It's like pure, innocent joy turned inside out into evil.
And here's another variation. Some regions portray the Tyanek a bit differently in appearance. In a few folk stores, after you pick up the baby and it transforms, it doesn't stay baby-like. Instead, it might turn into a small old man, like a dwarfish, goblin-like creature. One Tagalog story claimed that Tyanek's true form was a little old man with wrinkled skin, a long beard, a flat nose, and eyes as big as coins. It even had a deformity, one leg shorter than the other, so it couldn't run well, only hop or crawl. That's why it needs to lure victims instead of chasing them on foot.
Oh, that's fascinating. It almost blends into Duende, dwarf goblin territory?
Exactly. It blurs the line between a nature spirit and the vampiric demon. Perhaps in those areas the Tyanek legend merged with existing dwarf folklore.
Other local variants I've heard. In the island of Mindoro, they say sometimes after attacking, the Tyanek can shapeshift into a black bird and fly away into the night. That's a curious one, like a witch's Aswang escape tactic, turning into a bird.
Yep. There's also a version in Pampanga where the Tyanek isn't even baby-like and look at all when revealed. It's described as a small, nut-brown humanoid that floats above the ground instead of walking. It still has childlike traits, but also big eyes, big mouth, and a high-pitched voice.
And in the province of Batangas, southern Luzon, folks say the Tyanek are literally just the souls of infants who died. So they appear as regular human babies lost in the wild, except for their eerie behavior. One Batanga belief even says when you hear of Tyanek crying softly, it means it's actually very near you. But if its cry is loud and wailing, then it could be farther off, almost opposite the normal expectation.
Which is a good tip if you ever find yourself in that situation. Loud cry might mean you have time to get away. A soft whimper, you might be in trouble. Because it's right under your nose.
So many permutations, but all equally creepy. In summary, but Tianok uses the mimicry of a helpless baby to draw you close, then shows itself as a deformed, malicious little creature that either looks like a fanged baby or a tiny monstrous imp. And then it attacks.
That's the core of it, and we'll get into some actual encounter stories in a bit, but I want to mention, given how scary and dangerous this creature is believed to be, Filipino folklore also has its recommended countermeasures. You're not completely helpless if you suspect a Tianok is around. Ines komlas ankaka pidila rashkain.
Yes, the survival guide. Step 1. Don't pick up strange babies in the woods. That's a given.
Seriously though, if you hear mysterious baby cries at night, most elders will tell you do not follow it. But let's say you get caught off guard and the Tianok has led you astray. There's a famous trick. Turn your clothes inside out.
That one always intrigued me. Why inside out clothes?
The lore says that doing so breaks the enchantment or confuses the Tianok. Supposedly, the creature finds it so absurd or funny that you'd wear your shirt wrong that it stops its attack, laughing, and lets you go. But, Noel...
Bizarre. But, hey, if I'm ever in that scenario, I'll happily make a fool of myself. Rip my shirt off, invert it, and wear it backward if it gives me a chance. Or, why, like in Bully, when he's out to get you, the guy looks like the real threat. What's more likely to happen? Take a look.
Same here. Additionally, loud noises can scare it off. Some say the noise of a New Year's celebration, firecrackers, pots, and pans clang will drive Tianoks away. It's like many evil spirits. They don't like a ruckus. Or perhaps the energy of a celebration.
Makes sense. Since New Year's in the Philippines is traditionally about making noise to ward off evil, so it doubles as a Tianok deterrent.
And of course, there are the classic Aswang deterrents. Garlic, holy objects like the rosary or holy water. People often lump Tianok with Aswang and Manananggal in terms of being warded off by prayer or religious items. Not sure if that's original or just an assumption because it's demonic.
One more. This is less a defense in the moment and more a way to save the lost soul. Some believe if you give the Tianok a name, you actually help it move on. There's this idea that the Tianok cries and rampages because it's nameless and stuck. By naming the child's spirit, you acknowledge it and perhaps baptize it in a way, allowing it to rest.
That's a very compassionate approach, isn't it? Instead of slaying the monster, you release it from its suffering. I've heard of people leaving out a white candle and saying a prayer for the lost infant soul. The candlelight is supposed to guide it to the afterlife.
It's touching, really. A hint of mercy in all this darkness. Of course, I'm not sure anyone actually wants to stick around when a Tianok is screeching and attacking to try the whole I name you routine, but in theory, it's a resolution.
Yeah, practically speaking, I think I'd be running more than naming, but it's good to know all the same.
Speaking of practically speaking, should we share a story of an encounter? I feel like we've set the stage pretty well with what a Tianok is and where it comes from. Maybe it's time for a real, or but believable, account to bring this to life.
Great idea. Let's move from the facts and into the folklore as it's told. I have a creepy story that was actually passed down in my family about an encounter with a Tianok back in the day. This is a story by my Lola, my grandmother told me when I was a teenager. And let me tell you, hearing this as a kid ensured I never wandered too far from home at night. I'll recount it as she used to, more or less in her voice. During the war, in the 1940s, Arbaria was a quiet little place by the foothills. One evening, my older sister, Emilia, went out with two friends to gather firewood before darkness fell. They were walking home at dusk, arms full of kindling, when they heard it, a soft cry coming from the bamboo thicket off the trail. Emilia motioned for her friends to listen. It was unmistakable, the weak, whimpering cry of a baby. It sounded just beyond a tall bamboo. The three girls looked at each other, puzzled. No one in the village had a new baby that we knew of, and certainly none would be left out here. Maybe, they thought, a family fleeing the war had passed by and gotten lost. Or maybe someone abandoned a child, not able to care for it. They couldn't just leave it without checking. Against their better judgment, they followed the sound into the grove. The further in they went, the louder the crying got. Emilia said her heart was pounding, partly from fear, because she remembered the old stories, but partly from worry that there really was an innocent baby in trouble. Soon they saw, in the dim light, a small bundle on the ground by a tree. It was wrapped in a tattered gray blanket. The cries were coming from inside. Emilia approached slowly. The other girls hung back, suddenly afraid. They whispered, "Don't. What if it's not?" But Emilia shushed them. She had a tender heart, you see. She crouched down and gently peeled back the top of the blanket. Inside was indeed an infant. A baby boy, maybe 6 months old. Cheeks sturdy, eyes shut tight as he wailed. Emilia was instantly overcome with maternal instinct. She carefully lifted the baby into her arms. "Sha, sha! It's okay, we've got you," she cooed. Strangely, the baby's crying faded the moment she held him. He felt a bit heavy for his apparent age, but warm. Emilia rocked him, trying to see if he was hurt. Her friends nervously glanced around. The forest was getting dark fast, and an eerie silence had fallen. No crickets, no birds, just the sound of the wind and the bamboo. "We should go," one friend hissed. "Bring the baby. We'll take him to the village, quickly." Emilia nodded and stood up with the baby. He had gone quiet, nestling against her. Too quiet, perhaps. As they hurried back toward the path, Emilia noticed the baby felt even heavier now, as if he'd suddenly grown. He also felt colder. She adjusted him in her arms. "We're almost home, little one," she whispered. That when she felt it, tiny fingers gripping a lock of her hair. "Hide." Emilia winced. "Ow." She stopped, and one of her friends turned to ask what happened. Before she could answer, a chilling giggle rose from the bundle. Emilia looked down at the baby in her arms. In the gloom, the child's face was now oddly shadowed. His eyes were open, she could sense it, but she couldn't see them clearly under the overhanging blanket. "Are you all right?" her friend asked, stepping closer with a lantern they'd brought. The light fell on Emilia and the infant, and the friends saw. The baby's cherubic face had contorted into a sneer. His eyes glinted a deep red, reflecting the lantern light like a cat's. Those weren't the eyes of a baby. They were far too intelligent, filled with malice. Emilia froze in horror. The tiny boy's mouth opened, and instead of a cry, out came a raspy, mocking laugh. "Yeah, yeah." That didn't sound human. Small, sharp teeth gleamed inside that little mouth. The creature was smiling at her. Her blood ran cold. "Tayanak!" her friend screamed, dropping the lantern in panic. In that split second, the creature's tiny hand yanked hard on Amelia's hair, pulling her face closer. It bared its teeth and lunged at her throat. Emilia stumbled back, throwing her arms up just as the tsitsanak snapped its jaws. Instead of her neck, it bit into her forearm. Emilia cried out. The bundle fell from her grip to the ground with a thud, but the creature did not. It clung to her arm, its form no longer that of a fragile infant. As it uncurled, it appeared more like a gaunt, shriveled toddler with wiry limbs. Its once round baby face was now shriveled and demonic, with a pronounced brow and those awful eyes. A foul stench, like rotten eggs and blood, wafted from it. Her friends were in such shock that for a heartbeat they just stood there screaming. The Tiyanak cackled, biting deeper. Emilia could see blood starting to trickle where those teeth pierced her skin. In pain and terror, she remembered something our own mother had told us. If you ever encounter a Tiyanak, confuse it, while the monster baby dangled off her other arm. Emilia frantically grasped at the hem of her shirt. She yanked her camisa, blouse, out of her waist, and with shaking fingers flipped it inside out over her head. It was awkward and half torn, but she managed to pull the garment back on, inverted. The Tiyanak paused its biting, as if perplexed. It loosened its grip and dropped to the ground. Alila's two friends, seeing this bizarre act, did the same. They each turned their skirts inside out in a flurry of cloth, not even thinking twice. The creature on the ground stared up at the three girls, tilting its head. Then it did something unexpected. It laughed. Not the eerie laugh from before, but a childlike giggle, almost gleeful. Perhaps the sight of these humans suddenly wearing their clothes wrong amused the little demon. Taking advantage of its momentary distraction, Emilia yelled, "Run!" The three of them bolted back toward the path. Behind them, the Tiyanak's giggle turned into an ear-splitting screech of rage upon realizing its prey was escaping. Emilia glanced over her shoulder just once and saw it illuminated by the fallen lantern's flame, a tiny silhouette standing on the path, eyes glowing and mouth open in a scream. But it didn't chase this time. Whether scared off by their inside-out clothes or by the approaching lights of the village, some neighbors had heard the commotion and were coming with torches, the creature scurried away into the forest, still shrieking. Emilia's arm had deep bite marks. She was lucky. A bit more and it might have hit an artery. The elders burned sage around her and recited prayers, as was the custom after a Tiyanak encounter. Over the next few days, others went looking for signs of a real baby just in case, but of course, there were none. Only a discarded gray blanket with spots of blood on it. From then on, everyone in our Bahio knew a baby's cry in the woods is not automatically a cry for help. It could very well be a trap set by a Tiyanak, waiting for another dental heart to ensnare Yasis Nofitsa. So that's the story Lola told us. And she was dead serious about it. She would say, if you hear Yak Nongbata, a baby's cry, when you're alone out there, you'd turn around and come home. If you must check, bring others. And lots of noise.
I have to admit, even knowing its folklore, that story made my skin crawl. The image of that little monster biting Emilia. And the detail of turning their clothes inside out. That's classic. Whether or not it truly confuses a Tiyanak, it clearly buys time, at least in the legends.
It's a memorable trick, for sure. Also, it shows how these stories serve as kind of cautionary tales. They teach you practical things. Don't wander off at dusk. Always go in groups. Remember your elders' wisdom. Heck, even a weird one like wear your shirt inside out if needed sticks with you.
And at the same time, they explain the unexplainable. Like if someone vanished or was found dead in the woods with strange wounds, people might say, ah, the Tiyanak got them, rather than some mundane tragedy. It's how communities made sense of random misfortunes.
Right. My grandma's story is set during wartime chaos everywhere. Yet the fear of the supernatural still loomed large in daily life. It gave them one more thing to watch out for. Or maybe an outlet for anxieties they couldn't control, like war and death.
That story also highlights something. The Tiyanak doesn't just attack random travelers. It specifically targets compassion. It waits for someone kind enough to pick up an abandoned baby. So, it kind of punishes the Good Samaritan.
That's a twisted morality, isn't it? It flips the script. Instead of do a good deed and you're rewarded, it's do a good deed and you might pay with your life. It instills a very specific fear of being deceived by innocence. It makes you second guess that cry for help.
And that's powerful in the horror sense. The safest, purest thing, a baby, and crying for help, becomes the ultimate red flag. It erodes trust in your own human instincts.
Exactly. That's one reason the Tiyanak legend endures. It's universally scary. You don't have to be Filipino to find the idea disturbing. It taps into something fundamental.
You know, hearing your Lola's account makes me wonder about other first-hand stories, Folklore often comes wrapped in these "my neighbor's cousin encountered one" anecdotes. Here, I actually recall a modern urban legend about a tayak in the city. Have you heard any of those? Like, there's one about a taxi driver in Manila who picks up a woman carrying a baby, and, well, it turns out the baby isn't exactly normal.
Oh, yes, I've heard a version of that. Usually, it's like a late-night taxi stops for a beautiful woman with a hood or veil carrying an infant. She gets in, quiet, gives an address. The driver tries to make small talk, but she's silent. When they reach the destination, often an old, dark house, the driver turns around and the lady has vanished, leaving only the baby on the back seat. The baby then gives an eerie laugh and disappears too, or worse, attacks the driver. Sometimes the address she gave turns out to be an abandoned lot or a cemetery.
Classic urban ghost story vibes, mixing the Tiahnaaq idea with the vanishing hitchhiker motif. But it shows how these old myths adapt to new settings. Forests and barrios in the old days, now perhaps dark city streets and empty buildings.
For sure. I've even heard a tongue-in-cheek office Tiahnaaq joke, like if you hear a baby crying in the office restroom. Run! Ha-ha! But that's more humor than lore.
On the other hand, some communities still take it very seriously. In remote areas, you might find folks who swear they've heard mysterious cries at night and wouldn't dare investigate. Or mothers who lost a child, claiming they sometimes hear their baby's voice on the wind.
That actually leads us into another aspect we should explore, the cultural beliefs and superstitions around Tiahnaaqs, especially relating to those lost infants and grieving parents. We've touched on it, but let's dive deeper into what people traditionally believe the Tiahnaaq is, beyond the physical monster, like why it exists, what it represents to them spiritually or emotionally.
So, culturally, the Tiahnaaq is more than just a scary creature to frighten kids, though it certainly does that job well. It's also deeply tied to how people historically dealt with infant death and the unknowns of childbirth, right?
Yes. Remember, in earlier times and even today in some areas, infant mortality was tragically common. Babies would sometimes be stillborn or die very young. It's a devastating thing for parents and communities to experience. The Tiahnaaq legend, one angle, is a way to make sense of those losses. Instead of the baby simply being gone, the folklore suggests the baby's spirit is still here, albeit transformed.
Transformed and often angry or longing. There's a belief I've heard that Tiahnaaq is basically a lost soul that missed out on a proper life. If it's the spirit of a stillborn or unbaptized baby, it's in this sort of limbo. It didn't get the chance to be welcomed into the community through baptism or even being given a name, and that might be why it harbors anger. It's like it's saying, "Why did you forget me? Why did I get no love, no identity?"
That's heartbreaking if you think of it that way. It flips our perspective, seeing the Tiahnaaq not just as a predator, but as a victim too, a victim of circumstance, taking revenge on the living out of pain.
In that sense, the Tiahnaaq could symbolize the community's guilt or fears around infant deaths. For example, if a baby died before baptism, maybe the parents or midwife felt guilty, worrying the soul wouldn't rest. The story of the Tiahnaaq externalizes that fear. Instead of just internal guilt, there's now a physical creature embodying the unrest.
It also served as a caution against certain taboos. We already mentioned how it could be used to warn against abortion, essentially saying, "Don't do it, or you'll create a monster that will come after you." That's a pretty heavy-handed moral message, but folklore has never been shy about dramatizing consequences.
And consider cases of infanticide or child abandonment, which, though rare, did happen in history due to extreme poverty or stigma. The Tiahnaaq myth could have acted as a kind of social deterrent. If a mother was thinking of abandoning a baby, the fear that the baby's spirit would return as a vicious Tiahnaaq might dissuade her.
Or if a baby was born with deformities or illnesses in older times, superstitious folk might label it a changeling or a demon child. There's an uncomfortable historical possibility. some infants that were different might have been abandoned or even killed, with people rationalizing the act by saying it was an impacto, not a normal child. Folklore sometimes provided justifications for what we now recognize as cruel deeds. It's the dark side of these myths.
Yes. That aspect is disturbing. Using the myth to excuse mistreating a child. Thankfully, that's not a common narrative we hear now. But it's worth acknowledging that our legends have been used in various ways, both to teach and to rationalize.
On a lighter note, superstition-wise, there are also preventative practices expecting parents would follow to avoid having their child turn into a tiyanak, or being taken by one. For instance, some believe that if a baby dies, you should immediately baptize it, even in death, or at least give it a name and a proper blessing. That way its soul is at peace and won't roam around.
I've heard of wakes for infants where specific prayers are said to guard the soul, precisely so it doesn't become a restless spirit. In some rural areas, they even put a bit of garlic or ash in the baby's burial cloth. Garlic to ward off evil in case an aswang or some demon might want to claim the body, and ash to symbolize the earth. Maybe to keep the spirit grounded and calm.
Also, remember the Spanish friar's account we read? He described how when a woman was about to give birth, the husband and others would perform rituals to protect mother and baby from witches and evil spirits like the Patianak. In one account, men would strip naked, obviously, and wield swords around the house, slashing at the air, basically to scare off any lurking entity that might want to snatch the newborn soul or harm the mother.
That's an intense image. Dad and uncles playing samurai in the yard during labor. But it shows how real the fear was. Childbirth was a dangerous threshold. Life and death hung in the balance, and people did whatever they could, spiritually and physically, to ensure a positive outcome. The Patianak, or Tiyanak, was one of those threats they prepared for.
And if the worst happened, if mother or child didn't survive, they might attribute it to supernatural interference, like the Patianak caught to them, or a witch's curse. It was easier sometimes than facing the harsh natural reality. It gave them a reason, something to fight against or blame, rather than just random tragedy.
In terms of day-to-day superstition, I know people who, to this day, when they hear a weird crying or even a cat's meow that sounds like a baby, will mutter a protective prayer or say, "Tabi tabi po," a polite phrase meaning excuse us to the spirits, just in case. It's like a reflex ingrained from these tales.
I do that. Ha ha! If I'm somewhere remote and I think I hear something odd, I absolutely go tabi tabi po makikiran under my breath. It's meant usually for dwarves or spirits, but can't hurt covering all bases, including potential tiyanaks listening.
Culturally, the Tiyanak sits at a crossroads of fear, guilt, and reverence for the spirit world. It reminds people to honor those who died too soon by...
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Naming them, praying for them, to adhere to community rituals like baptism, and to be cautious of the unknown.
And maybe, on a psychological level, it also provided a coping mechanism. Think of a grieving mother who lost her baby before baptism. As horribly sad as it is to imagine her thinking her baby became a monster, it also means in her mind the baby still exists in some form. She might even believe there's something she can do, like the naming or the candle, to help the baby's soul. In a twisted way, the horror story gives a kind of hope, or at least an action to take, rather than just an empty loss.
That's a very empathetic take. Folklore often has that dual role, to scare, but also to offer explanations and sometimes even solutions, no matter how supernatural. It's like telling a mother your child's soul is still out there. It's troubled, but you can still care for it by appeasing it.
Right. And communities collectively shared that burden. The story becomes a way for everyone to acknowledge the tragedy, like many babies died in our village this year, maybe Kankakto, and also encourage everyone to participate in protective customs, hold a noisy celebration, etc., to ward it off, which doubles as a communal catharsis, perhaps.
This is deep stuff. Beyond the jump scare aspect of the Tiahnaq, we're talking about communal psychology and spirituality here, and it shows why the Tiahnaq is such a potent figure in our folklore. It hits so many notes. Fear of deception, loss of innocent life, religious duty, and even the inversion of parental instinct.
It really is the perfect horror story ingredient. And speaking of horror stories, maybe we should lighten the mood just a little by talking about how the Tiahnaq has found its way into pop culture and modern media. Because, as scary as it is, we Filipinos also love to turn our folklore into entertainment. Films, TV shows, comics, you name it.
Oh, absolutely. The Tiahnaq has been a star powwow, or maybe a cult favorite in Filipino horror cinema especially. Let's geek out on that for a bit.
If you grew up in the Philippines, chances are your first encounter with a visual Tiahnaq was via a movie or TV show rather than an actual forest, hopefully. One of the most iconic is the 1988 film Tiahnaq.
Oh, yes. Directed by Piquillala and Lores, if I recall correctly. That movie gave an entire generation nightmares. The Tiahnaq in that film looked truly horrifying. Practical effects and puppetry at their peak 1980s glory. It had bulging eyes, a wide mouth with fangs, kind of like a grayish demonic baby that could scurry around.
I remember seeing clips of it peeking from behind curtains or crawling under beds. So creepy. And the tagline was famous, Takbo Tiahnaq, which is a pun. It means run, run. It's a Tiahnaq. Tiahnaq also sounds like there's a child. They really cemented how a Tiahnaq might act on screen.
Fun fact, that depiction is probably what most people visualize when they hear Tiahnaq now, a monstrous baby doll with a devilish face. It's become kind of the default image.
Before that, there was actually an older film simply titled Tiahnaq in 1953, black and white, I think. I haven't seen it, it's quite rare, but it shows the legend has been in Filipino cinema for a long time.
And you can't talk Pinoy horror without mentioning Shake, Rattle, and Roll, the long-running horror anthology film series. They've featured the Tiahnaq at least a couple of times. I recall Shake, Rattle, and Roll 2, 1990, had a segment with the Tiahnaq. And more recently, Shake, Rattle, and Roll 15 also revisited the creature.
In those, they sometimes put a new twist, like twin Tiahnaqs or something along those lines. One had a weird comedic tinge with Gumball na Tiahnaq in a film called Tenga, which was more of a horror comedy. I think it had two little monster babies causing chaos, and the protagonist was a goofy hero.
There's also Tiahnaqs. Notice the plural. That one had multiple Tiahnaq creatures, kind of like a pack of demon babies, terrorizing a group of college kids stranded in the wilderness. Because why have one when you can have an army, right?
Maximum chaos. And if I recall, Tiahnaq sort of acted like little gremlin-like critters hunting in a group.
A more modern retelling was Tiahnaq in 2014. They used the apostrophe, stylizing the old term. I think that one attempted to mix classic horror with a bit of emotional drama about a family that encounters a creature.
On television, the Tiahnaq pops up too. A popular fantasy series for kids, Super Ingo, 2006, had Tiahnaqs. They call them Junanaqs in a comedic way. The show was campy, so these were like minion monsters the child superhero had to deal with. It was scary funny seeing a bunch of little monsters that used to be babies.
And I remember the TV series Juan de la Cruz, 2013, which was about a hero fighting mythical creatures, had an episode with Tiahnaqs. They often integrate creatures like the Menenangal, Capre, etc., and Tiahnaq got its cameo as well.
Now on the international stage, the Tiahnaq got a spotlight in the Netflix animated series Theresa. 2021. Theresa is based on a Philippine graphic novel, and it's full of our folklore beings. In one episode, a clan of Tienex was featured. Those were particularly creepy, animated as long-limbed, pale, baby-like creatures that could crawl on ceilings and walls like spiders.
Yes. Teresa's version was nightmare fuel. The Tienex there were also shown as the offspring of a powerful Aswang, tying into that lore of demon parentage. And the protagonist, Alexandra Treese, had to deal with them. I won't spoil, but it was a standout sequence.
Aside from films and TV, Tienex appear in Philippine comics and literature. They're part of the roster of underworld creatures that any fantasy/horror writer in the Philippines love to play with. You'll find them in short stories, maybe even in the Treese comics themselves, beyond the show.
They also appear in games. I know the MMORPG Ragnarok Online added a Philippine folklore-themed area and included Tienex as one of the monsters you could fight. So gamers got to hack and slash at demon babies, which is morbid fun, I suppose.
There's even a reference in a card game called Hellmaster. I haven't played it, but apparently Tienex is represented by a card there. And one of our creatures, Toyol in Malaysian lore, a goblin child used by sorcerers, is conceptually similar and has been in regional media too, though Toyol are more like little thieves than feral monsters.
What I love is that the Tienex, despite being so region-specific, resonates enough that even non-Filipinos find it fascinating. It's been mentioned in lists of scary folklore around the world on YouTube channels and whatnot. You sometimes see illustrations of it by foreign artists who are intrigued by the concept.
It's true. We have our own local creature feature mythology that's as rich as vampires and werewolves. In fact, some Western horror aficionados compared the Tienex to things like the changeling myth in Europe, where a fairy switches a baby with a duplicate, or to movies like Rosemary's Baby and The Omen, which play on the idea of evil infant or children. The idea of a creepy kid is universal, but ours starts at baby stage.
And the Tienex definitely stands out, even among our pantheon of Aswangs, Mananangs, Capres, etc. I mean, all those are scary, but something about the Tienex tends to freak people out more viscerally. Perhaps because babies are usually never the villain. It feels taboo. Like sin or grace or something?
Exactly. We expect monsters to be ugly, old, huge, or bestial, not adorable and tiny. So when a baby is the monster, it crosses a line that gives you that extra jolt of discomfort.
Pop culture has leveraged that well. And I think the reason we see Tienex in so many movies is because Filipinos both fear the concept and are intrigued by it. It's like we can't look away. Plus, on a practical level, it's a great special effects challenge. How to make a convincing demon baby on screen.
Right. Many a makeup artist has had their work cut out for them designing those props.
I remember the laughter in the cinema when, in one shake, rattle, and roll segment, they had what looked like a toddler in a monster suit chasing the actors. It was scary, but also a tiny bit funny because, you know, it's small. There's that mix of horror and absurdity that sometimes creeps in. But then when the close-up came of its face, the laughter died quick. Everyone was shrieking.
The absurdity might actually be part of why it's nightmare fuel. Your brain is like, this shouldn't be happening. Babies are innocent, and the mismatch makes it deeply unsettling. It's almost darkly comedic on paper, but in person, it's terrifying.
And thematically, modern filmmakers and writers sometimes use the Tienex to comment on things. Like a movie might subtly critique how society neglects certain groups by showing an abandoned baby become a literal monster, or explore a mother's guilt or trauma by externalizing it as a Tienex haunting her.
Yes, the Tienex there is a great metaphor when used that way. I recall a short story, think by Budget 10, Raider of Trise, where a Tienex encounter is laced with the mother's perspective and sorrow. It's not just a jump scare, it's an emotional punch.
And with that said, maybe it's time we pivot to exactly that. What does the Tienex symbolize for us, And why does it endure as one of those creatures we still talk about in hushed tones? We've covered origins, behaviors, stories, and pop culture, but let's talk meaning and fear before we conclude with our final chilling story.
Good idea. Let's reflect on why the Tiannak has the effect it does on us, even in this modern age.
When we strip away the blood-curdling details and look at the core of the Tiannak legend, what do we see? What does the Tiannak mean to us as a society?
One big symbol the Tiannak carries is the idea of innocence betrayed or corrupted. The most innocent image, an infant, turns out to be deadly. It's a reversal that hits home. It's like saying, nothing is sacred, even the purest thing can hide evil. That's a fear that speaks to a fundamental insecurity. How can we trust the world if even a crying baby might be a monster?
It's almost a loss of innocence story on a cultural level. Maybe it reflects historical experiences too. Think about colonization. Natives welcomed strangers, like colonizers, thinking they were friends or helpless. Some came as supposed allies or in need, but then those turned out to be harmful. A bit of a stretch, but one could see the Tiannak as symbolizing the experience of trusting something or someone seemingly benign and being betrayed.
That's an interesting interpretation, reading it as an allegory for other things. At the very least, it definitely resonates with personal experiences of betrayal. And also caution, not everything that cries deserves your pity could be an underlying message. Sort of a grim lesson, keep your wits about you. Keep your wits about you, and his evil can disguise itself as helplessness.
Religiously, the Tiannak symbolism is tied to ideas of salvation and damnation. It's like the embodiment of a soul stuck in limbo, or perhaps even a hint of demonic possession. The creature's existence is a direct challenge to the comforting idea that all babies are angels. It suggests an alternative. An unbaptized or nameless child might become something else, which reinforces the value placed on those religious rituals. Symbolically, the Tiannak is what happens when something falls outside the sanctioned order, like a child outside baptism.
On a psychological front, we touched on how it could represent grief and guilt. A parent who lost a baby might hear a Tiannak at night. This could be a manifestation of their own guilt. I should have done more, now my child is unhappy in the afterlife, or their grief projecting cries into the night. Many mothers who lose infants speak of hearing phantom crying. The Tiannak gives that phenomenon a name and a face, albeit a terrifying one.
And socially, the Tiannak might embody our collective fear of neglect and abandonment. I mean, a lot of Tiannak origin stories revolve around a baby who wasn't properly cared for. The answer is no baptism or physically. Abandoned, aborted, lost. The result? A literal little monster. It's like a moral equation. Neglect the most vulnerable, and you create a monster, figuratively in society, or literally in folklore.
That's a great point. In that sense, the Tiannak could be saying, take care of your children, honor them even in death, or face the consequences. It's a boogeyman, but one that channels a community's values. Communities that valued baptism and proper burial for all, including babies, reinforced those values with this legend. And communities that feared outsiders harming their young, like witches or aswangs, used it to justify protective practices.
Also, not to be overlooked, fear of the wild, of nature. Forests and folklore are liminal spaces where anything can happen. The Tiannak cry lures people off the safe path and deeper into the jungle, where they get lost or killed. It's symbolic of how the wild can deceive and destroy those who aren't careful. Very much a don't stray from the path fairy tale vibe, akin to Hansel and Gretel or Red Riding Hood warnings.
Yes, the forest is beautiful, but also deadly if you venture without caution. The Tiannak is like the spirit of the forest trickster in some interpretations. There are similar creatures worldwide, like a will-o'-the-wisps in Europe, that lead travelers astray. So, symbolically, it's the unknown natural world, luring civilized folks to their doom.
And there's something to be said about the symbolism of size. We fear big monsters, but the Tiannak is tiny. Yet it shows that even something small can be lethal. Small but terrible, as the saying goes. Maybe a cultural note on not underestimating things or based on appearance,
True, it humbles you. The bravest warrior could be undone by a foe he could literally cradle in his arms. That's almost poetic justice, or at least a reminder that strength and danger aren't always obvious.
The longevity of the Tianakan stories today indicates it still touches nerves. I mean, even with science and modern life, we still find the concept frightening. Perhaps nowadays it speaks to modern fears in different forms, like the fear of something being wrong with one's child, postpartum anxieties, for instance, where a mother might irrationally fear her baby isn't really her baby, a known symptom in some postpartum mental illnesses. The Tianak is almost like a nightmare version of that fear. What if my baby isn't what it seems? What if it's a monster and I, the parent, didn't know?
That's a chilling lens, the fear of parenthood and not understanding this crying being you're responsible for. Babies can be scary in real life. Sleepless nights, constant crying that you sometimes can't soothe, and a new parent might half-jokingly say, "This kid is a little monster." Tianak is that concept dialed up to 100. The kid Zuzuzu, kids pickaxe pot the meth style.
At the end of the day, the Tianak stands as one of those ultimate cautionary tales. It cautions compassion. It cautions care of children. It cautions respect for the dead. It cautions against the unknown. And it wraps it all in a bone-chilling package of horror.
And like many great horror figures, it also generates empathy in a roundabout way. We fear it, yes, but when you think about why it exists, a forsaken child, there's a pang of sorrow there. The best monsters are the ones you can feel a little sorry for, even as they scare the pants off you.
Well said. The Tianak is as much a tragedy as it is a terror.
Exactly. And I think exploring that tragic aspect is the perfect lead-in to our final segment. We promised a fictional story from the perspective of a haunted parent. This will bring everything we discussed to a poignant, eerie climax.
We've seen the Tianak as the monster in the woods from an outsider's view. Now let's imagine it from a more intimate point of view. A parent who has lost a child, and the cries they cannot escape.
Grab a tissue and hold on to your sanity. This last story might just break your heart and send a shiver down your spine at the same time. I'm going to take on the voice of that parent now, telling their tale. I never wanted to believe in monsters, even growing up on folklore and ghost stories. I thought our elders made them up to scare us. I considered myself rational. But that was before I became a mother. Before I lost my baby and started hearing the crying. I was 22 when my son Tomas was born. He came into this world on a stormy night, tiny and premature. I remember the flicker of the oil lamp beside my mat as the midwife handed him to me. He was so small, his eyes squeezed shut, his cry barely a squeak. But he lived. Oh, how he fought to live those first weeks. I prayed over him every day. Being young and unmarried in our village was hard, I'll admit. There were whispers that my baby was a punishment or a shame, but to me, little Tomas was everything. I loved him fiercely, more than I thought my heart could bear. The fevers came when he was just 1 month old. A simple cold, the healer said, but it burned him up from inside. I did everything, cooled his body with damp cloths, boiled guava leaves for a bath, held him day and night. Still the fever raged. His cries grew weaker by the day until one morning they just stopped. He stopped. My boy was gone, his tiny body finally at peace, while my world shattered. In our Catholic Church, they say unbaptized babies go to limbo, not heaven. Tomas had been too sick to take to the priest, so he died without baptism. The priest muttered about God's mercy nonetheless, but the old folks, they said other things. And that I should have given him a name and a quick baptism at home, that I should at least bury him in blessed ground. But I had nothing, no money for a cemetery plot or a priest service. In my despair, I buried my child myself at the edge of the forest behind her house. Under a bali tree. I marked the spot with a small wooden cross I carved. I sang him a lullaby as I laid him down, tears soaking the earth. Bayou Bayou, to Log Nahanak, thither that emptiness. A hollow silence in the house. I would wake in the dead of night, reaching for a baby that wasn't there. I'd sit on my mat and sob until dawn. Neighbors came by with kind words, but some were superstitious. One woman left a rosary on my doorstep, whispering, "For the little one, so he doesn't wander." I didn't know what she meant. A week after the burial, I started to hear it. At first, I thought it was my mind playing tricks. The first time was near midnight. I woke from a light sleep, heart pounding for no reason, and then I heard a sound through the open window. A faint crying. It was distant, like the mewling of a kitten. I sat up, straining to listen. The night was so dark, clouds covered the moon. Again, a tiny wail, drifting on the humid air. My breasts ached and fleeked milk, something that happened when Thomas cried. It was as if my body recognized my baby's cry. I stumbled to the window and called out, "Thomas?" before catching myself. There was no answer, only the chirr of crickets. Eventually, the crying stopped. I fell back into a troubled sleep, dreaming of my boy whimpering somewhere cold and alone. The next day, I searched around the house, half ashamed of myself. Of course, I found nothing, but the sound preyed on my mind. Was it a stray cat? A bird? Perhaps a tarsier in the trees with a cry like an infant? I rationalized it away. Night came. I bolted my door, lit a candle by Tomas's little shrine I had set up a corner with his swaddling cloth and a few toys, trying to make peace. I managed to sleep a bit, clutching the cloth that still smelled of him. Then, at around 2 a.m., I woke with a start. The candle had guttered out. The air was thick and still. I realized what had woken me. I heard him again. Clearer this time. I was crying unmistakably outside my window. Not distant. This time it sounded as if it were coming from the forest's edge. My heart thundered. That was my Tomas's voice, I was sure of it. No mother mistakes her own child's cry. Now it wasn't exactly the same. There was something off, a strange echo to it, but it was close enough. I threw on a shawl and rushed outside. The moon had come out, bathing the clearing and the first line of trees in a silvery light. "Thomas," I called softly. The crying continued, a thin wail from just beyond the first trees, near where I had buried him. I stepped forward, barefoot on the damp grass. The night smelled of rain and earth. At the tree line, I hesitated. The crying was louder now, but I couldn't pinpoint it. It seemed to swirl around. My skin prickled with goosebumps. Part of me was terrified. This couldn't be real. My baby was gone. Was he? Could his spirit be calling out to me, or was something else imitating his voice? I had heard the village tales of Tiyanak, of course. Every Filipino has, but in that moment, grief spoke louder than fear. If there was any chance at all, that it was my child's soul crying for me, I had to go. Maybe he's lost, I thought crazily. Maybe he needs his mother to guide him. I grabbed a lantern and ventured under the canopy. The jungle looked black and white in the moonlight, shadows upon shadows. "Anakorawan," I whispered. "Mama is here." The crying seemed to respond, turning into a soft whimper. I followed, deeper in, each step heavy with dread and desperate hope. Finally, I reached the baleti tree where he was buried. The little wooden cross was still there, illuminated faintly by my lantern. The crying had stopped. Instead, there was a silence so complete I could hear my own heart beat in my ears. I knelt by the grave, choking back tears. "My baby, I'm sorry," I murmured, brushing leaves off the grave. I must have looked mad, kneeling alone in the dark, apologizing to the air. I wept, clutching the ground. "I'm sorry I didn't baptize you. I'm sorry you're out here in the dark. Mommy is here now." In the quiet that followed, I suddenly felt not alone. An unnerving sensation crept over me, like I was being watched from the darkness between the trees. I held up my lantern, its flame shaking. "Tomas?" I called softly. From behind the massive trunk of the velet, something peeked out. My breath caught. It was small and low to the ground. At first, I thought perhaps a python. We have big snakes here. Or a civet. But then a tiny figure crawled forward into the moonlight. It looked like to a baby. A little naked boy, perhaps 8 or 9 months old by the size of him. My heart leapt into my throat. In the dim light, I could just make out soft features, round cheeks. Could it be Thomas? I gasped, hardly believing. The figure's head tilted at the sound of the name. He began to crawl toward me, silently. As he moved, my lantern's light fell fully on him and a cold realization hit me. I recognized a birthmark on my baby's right shoulder, a small brown oval. This crawling child had that same mark. It was my Thomas. It had to be. Somehow, impossibly, my baby was here, out of the grave. I should have been frightened out of my wits, but a fierce joy ignited in me. I didn't stop to question further. I opened my arms, tears streaming. Plomis, come here, baby, I sobbed, Puro right into my arms. Warm and solid, I held him tight, lantern set aside. He felt real, so real. Little arms wrapping around my neck. He even smelled like I remembered, a mix of sweet milk and earth. Oh God, thank you, I cried, cradling him. I cannot describe the relief, the elation, the utter miracle I felt. My child was returned to me. Maybe all that praying, maybe God took pity. Tomas snuggled against me, but he was awfully quiet. No baby babble or coos, just deep shuddering breaths as if he had been crying for ages. I leaned back to look at him, wiping my tears to see clearly. He was staring up at me with eyes so large and dark. In the faint light, something about them made my stomach twist. They almost seemed to glint red, but I told myself, it was the reflection of the lantern flame. My sweet boy, I whispered. He just stared, unblinking, and then he did something he hadn't learned to do when he was alive. He smiled. It was a strangely wide smile, lips parting. Instinctively, I noticed things now that I hadn't in my initial rush. His skin was cold, unnaturally cold, as if he had been in water. Bits of mud clung to his arms and legs and his gums. When he smiled, I expected to see his cute, toothless grin. Instead, I caught a glimpse of something small and white. Multiple somethings peeking from his gums. A chill trickled through me. Tomas, I said again, uncertainty creeping in. He giggled, a sound I had never heard from him before. It sounded like the tinkle of tiny bells mixed with a raspy undertone. I held him out slightly from me, and in the light I now saw clearly. Tiny teeth had sprouted in his once toothless mouth. Not baby teeth. These looked sharp, triangular. My heart lurched. This wasn't right. No, no. As I stared in mounting horror, my baby's face began to change before my eyes. His innocent grin stretched wider, the corners of his mouth nearly reaching his ears in an unnatural grimace. His eyes, which I thought were just in shadow, now definitely glowed with a dim crimson light. The soft cooing turned into a low, gurgling growl. I screamed and almost dropped him. His little hands clamped onto my forearms tightly, much tighter than any infant's grip. Tomas, stop! I cried in panic, still half in disbelief. My beloved son's features twisted into something out of a nightmare. His once plump cheeks sunk, revealing high cheekbones and a gaunt look, and his previously sweet expression contorted with malice. He opened his mouth and let out a wail, a piercing, shrill cry that was not my Tomas's cry. It was a sound I'd been hearing at night, but magnified. Filled with anger, the cry surrounded me, echoing through the trees until I couldn't tell where it truly came from. I clapped my hands over my ears, dropping the lantern. In the sudden dark, I felt a sharp pain, lanced through my left shoulder. I staggered. He had bitten me, those razor-like teeth sinking into me like a tiny predator. I gasped in pain. Reflex took over, and I pushed him away. He fell to the ground at my feet with a thud and a hiss. The clouds shifted, and a beam of moonlight shone down on us through the belighted branches. I saw the creature that had been my son, had worn the form of my son, crouching on all fours. It looked up at me and let out a different cry, a mocking cackle that had an infant's timbre, but a demon's wickedness. Its eyes were glowing brighter now, fixed on me with sheer hatred. I realized then, in heartbroken horror, that this was no miracle. This was a Tianic. The stories were true. My child's unrested soul, or some demon taking his shape, had lured me here. I should have run, but behind the creature, I saw the disturbed earth of the grave I had dug for my baby. The soil was churned as if something had crawled out. My knees almost buckled at the implication. I had to know. I had to see. Keeping my eyes on the creature, I edged toward the grave. The Tianak crouched, but oddly did not attack immediately. It watched with a curious tilt of the head, perhaps savoring my despair. With trembling hands, I pawed at the dirt by the little cross. I dug frantically. Within moments, I uncovered the small blanket I had wrapped Amas in for burial. I pulled it up, empty. Empty save for clumps of mud and leaves. The tiny body was gone. A keening wail escaped my own throat. At that sound, Tianak hissed and crawled closer. I clutched the blanket to my chest. My mind was splitting. Part of me still sobbed for my lost baby. The other part was screaming at me to survive, to get away from this thing that had taken his place. "Why?" I whimpered at the creature, tears streaming. It only answered with that infernal giggle. Then it lunged at me again, surprisingly fast. I barely scrambled back in time. The Tianak's claw-like hands swiped the air inches from my face. I fell onto my back. The creature landed on my legs, pinning me with shocking strength for something so small. I felt claws or nails digging through my skirt. I remembered, suddenly, what the story said and how to break the enchantment. But I was in my night clothes, just a loose dress. I wasn't even wearing a jacket or anything I could easily remove or flip. And I was so afraid. The Tianak crawled up my torso with inhuman agility, drool dripping from its fanged mouth onto my chest. It seemed to delight in my terror, those glowing eyes locked onto mine. I could see its face clearly now. It was my son's face, in some ways, but twisted. Skin grayish, veins dark beneath, and that grin, that awful grin. In a choked voice, I did the only thing I could think of. I began to sing the lullaby I used to sing to Tomos every night. Ilili tu logane valadire imomane. Sleep for now, your mother is not here. I sang it through sobs, my voice shaking. The creature paused, cocking its head as if listening. For a moment, the red in its eyes dimmed and its grin slackened, almost like it was curious or remembering. The hair on my nape point. I kept singing, my voice barely above a whisper. Ilili tulugde. My hands were free, so with one hand I gingerly reached into my pocket and pulled out the rosary that neighbor had given me. With the other hand, I slowly made the sign of the cross in the air between me and the Tianak. At the sight of the rosary's pale beads catching the moonlight, the creature shrieked in sudden rage or pain. I'm not sure which. It recoiled, covering its eyes with one tiny arm. That was my chance. I threw the rosary at it and, with all my will, shoved the small monster off me. And after a moment, it tumbled to the side, hissing furiously. I scrambled to my feet, clutching that mud-stained burial blanket, one last piece of my child, and ran. I ran like I've never run before, out of the trees and back toward the house. As I fled, I heard a wail behind me. This time, not a cry of a baby, but a sound like a wounded animal and a furious infant combined. I glanced back just once and saw the silhouette at the edge of the forest. Small, standing upright now, watching me. I could sense its eyes burning into my back. I didn't stop until I was inside my house, door barred, every lamp lit. App was last night. Now I sit here at dawn, writing this by shaky candlelight, the blanket still clutched in my lap. There are bruises and bite marks on my skin, to my horror, proof that it wasn't just a nightmare. I bandage the bite on my shoulder. It's deep and throbs with each heartbeat. I've prayed nonstop for forgiveness, begging God to forgive me for not giving Tomas a proper baptism, for whatever mistake led to his soul becoming that thing. I prayed for God to reclaim my child's spirit and send the demon away. I don't know if my child was truly in that creature, or if something else wore his face, but either thought is almost too much to bear. The villagers will wake soon. I think I must tell the elder and the priest, as much as they might judge me or call me hysterical. If there is a ritual to put a soul to rest, I'll do it. I have heard of naming a lost baby to give it peace. I will name him now, properly, in front of a crucifix, and baptize the ear if I have to. I'll bury a blessed candle by the Baletti tree to light his way to heaven. I'll do anything, anything, to help my little one find light. But deep in my heart, dread nightfall again, because I know I'll hear that cry again. The cry that is identical to my Tomas, and yet not him. And I fear my resolve might break. Despite everything, part of me aches to hold him again, even knowing what he truly is now. That's the cruelest torture, that Tiannak knows I will always long for my child. It uses that against me. I can already hear a faint echo of a whimper in my mind, though it's broad daylight now. Perhaps I'm going mad from grief and pain, or perhaps he's already calling to me, even under the sun. All I know is, as his mother, I'm bound to him, in love, in life, and now even in this horror, I'll either save his soul tonight, or the monster wearing his face will take me too. Either way, my baby and I will be together, in peace, or in perdition. The crying has begun anew as dusk approaches. I must go. The priest is here to help. If this letter is found unfinished, then I have likely followed the cries into the darkness once more. Pray for us.
My God. That was intense, Alex. I'm at a loss for words. That poor mother.
And it's a fictional account, but rooted in the very real emotions that orbit the Tiannak legend. Grief, love, and horror, all tangled up.
It really highlights the tragic aspect of the Tiannak, how it's not just about a monster chasing someone, but about a parent's worst nightmare, losing a child and then having that loss perverted into something terrifying.
Indeed. It's one thing to face a monster, it's another to face it wearing the face of your loved one. That's a torment beyond physical harm.
After hearing that, I feel like I want to go hug all the people I care about and, I don't know, light a candle or something.
I know what you mean. The story lingers. It casts the Tiannak not just as a jump scare creature, but as a symbol of unresolved sorrow.
And it makes you respect our ancestors who came up with these tales. They embedded so much meaning and emotion in them.
Absolutely. These creatures of the night, like the Tiannak, carry centuries of our hopes, fears, and lessons in their stories. They're a mirror reflecting parts of the human experience, albeit a dark, distorted mirror.
So, after everything we've discussed tonight, from the origins of the Tiannak to spine-tingling encounters and the cultural soul behind the monster, what are your final thoughts?
My final thought is one of appreciation and caution. Appreciation that our folklore is so rich that it can at once scare us and move us. And caution that even in modern times, we shouldn't entirely dismiss the old warnings. Not that I expect to find a demon baby in my backyard, but the underlying advice to be careful of deceptive appearances and to honor those who passed, that's timeless.
Well said. And I'd add, perhaps the best way to defeat a Tiannak, metaphorically, is through compassion and remembrance. Name the lost souls, remember them, and they won't need to cry in the dark for us.
Beautifully put, Reed.
To our listeners, we hope you found this journey into the Philippine night both frightening and enlightening. I know I did. If you hear a baby's cry in the woods or perhaps outside your window when you know there shouldn't be any, well, you now know what might be lurking.
Turn your clothes inside out, make some noise, and don't go picking up any strange bundles on lonely paths.
More importantly, cherish the innocence in your life. The legend of the Tiahnaq, as horrifying as it is, reminds us never to take the lives of children for granted, and to respect and care for them in life and in death.
This has been Stories Philippines Podcast, Episode 3, The Tiahnaq's Cry, Lullabies of Doom. Thank you for staying with us through this chilling exploration. We hope we didn't scare you away from ever soothing a crying baby, but maybe just from wandering toward eerie cries in the night.
I'm Reed, and I'll be double-checking every weird sound I hear tonight.
And I'm Alex, probably sleeping with her rosary under my pillow, just in case.
Till next time, sweet dreams.
And remember, not every cry in the darkness is what it seems. Sometimes a lullaby can be a lure. Good night, and take care. Thank you.